I would work here at the PI for 1 year, and I would like to introduce to you Professor Maya Kapaczewski. She's a well-known expert on complex systems, and it is her initiative to start and launch a new series of seminars. So I would like to advertise a series of seminars we call Spring Seminars on Complexity and Networks. And as you see, they will be organized here in this room, also on Thursdays at 2 p.m. So we basically observed that your call was very much successful, and we would like to make use of this observation and, in a sense, continue it. So you will get, I hope by email, exact information about it. So first course will be given on May 19 by Maya here in this place, and you will get additional information by email. And then I will also ask you, as you will get this information someday, please try to distribute it among other people who might be interested. Thank you very much. So the one more, that's the first seminar.
Yeah, so we'll have various people give talks. I'll be giving the first talk, which will be about self-organized criticality. And these talks will be very general. You won't need to have an enormous amount of background in order to understand them. So self-organized criticality is one of the theories that has been proposed to explain the observation of complexity in nature. Why do we see complex systems other than everything appearing like a gas, random gas, something like that? Why do we see structures? Let me look at things at this scale in space and time. Another one of the talks will be by Peter Grassberger on what are good measures of complexity. I believe Carol will give a talk on voting.
Complexity concerning voting. Elections.
And then I will probably give, as well as someone else, a couple of talks on complex networks. And these have been quite a hot topic, not only in physics, but also in biology and various other science about how to describe complex. Okay, thanks.
Just a quick announcement. Let me start with a quick announcement about the course, the project in particular. So we've extended the deadline to emailed a couple of individuals, April 12th. April 12th, was it? At midnight? That's the Tuesday? Does anyone have a date handy? Yeah, April 12th at midnight, electronic submission at midnight. If you have very good reasons, we'll give you an extension until the 15th at 9 a.m., all right, on the 15th, which is Friday. You have to have a good reason, and the project's turning on the 15th will be held to a slightly higher standard. So that's your dilemma. I have to do that because the projects have to return the grades by the end of April, so I need some time to mark the projects. Okay, so that's it for the formal announcements. So today what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide up the time into two sections. In the first hour or so, I will talk a bit about some research I've done which has informed my opinion about quantum states and how to interpret them. And in particular, that's by studying the classical limit and studying the classical limit under extreme conditions, namely conditions of classical chaos. So I'll describe that. And then at the end of the lecture, what I'd like to do is have kind of interactive discussion where the students kind of lay out the different interpretations you've heard about, either in the course or in your reading outside of the course. So we'll have a little vote to see which one has been the most influential and you think is the most promising interpretation. Okay, so the question today is, what does the classical limit tell us about the significance, by which I mean interpretational significance, of quantum states? So a kind of a crude breakdown for the interpretation of quantum states, I could say that the possibilities one is that it's a complete description of reality. So in some sense, there are, so the state somehow maps on to, you know, everything that we think is real. So another option is that there are partial descriptions of what is real. So there are real, in other words, there are real objects, physical, objectively existing objects in the world, which the quantum state does not tell us about. So an example of this would be in the de Broglie model. And I emphasize that it's a partial description of what's real, because in the de Broglie model, and this is maybe a bit contentious, but kind of intuitively, the wave function pushes the particles around. So it has some kind of causal influence on the real coordinates described by the position. So in that sense, it is somehow real as some kind of force field through this quantum potential, which you learned about in your assignment. And so a third possibility is that quantum states, here I'm referring specifically to quantum states, right? And you know, ideally pure quantum states, is that quantum states have nothing real about them. That is, they provide statistical information only. So firstly, I'm not really decided between 2 and 3. I started out believing 3, and now I'm more towards 2, not necessarily de Broglie, but maybe something like it. But what the goal of this lecture is to try and convince you that we should discard 1.
Nothing real, that means they are complex.
No, I mean real in the sense of, thank you. So how am I going to do this? The classical limit. Probably the earliest work on the classical limit was from Ehrenfest. Who in 1927 published a nice result, which is now, in light of further development of the theory, is now a two-line proof. But at the time, it was a non-trivial, and you integrate by parts, and blah, blah, blah. And what he showed was that, so now, of course, expectation values, as usual, are defined as psi q psi, a time-dependent wave function in the Schrodinger picture. Explicitly here, I mean that they're operators. So what he showed was that the time development of the expectation values can be described by this pair of equations. And then what he further showed, sorry?
Do you want to get from Boyd to get that little bad?
Sure. So then he further observed, well, if we expand the force function about the quantum centroid, what we get is f evaluated in q plus q minus q times df by dq. Plus q minus q squared over 2. Q squared F by DQ squared. Plus higher order fraction. And then when we take the average of F of Q, we get F of Q. This term drops out. And we have the expectation, basically the variance of Q. And this is evaluated at Q equals Q hat. The reason I put the subscript Q hat here is because you can think of the classical function V, take its derivative, and then substitute the operator afterwards. But here I'm expanding about the quantum centroid. Expectation value, let me call it. Not to prejudice the discussion. And then he said, well, now if I think about the classical limit, then the uncertainty principle allows me to prepare very delta Q can be, well, delta Q times delta P can be very narrow compared to the scale of the variation in the potential. So remember, the force is the first derivative of the potential, and so we have three derivatives. So you can talk about this as some kind of characteristic length scale. I guess it would be, what would it be? It would be, why is that a length scale? I guess it has dimensions of 1 over length squared times some energy. And so the important thing is that it's the ratio of the variance delta Q, the object that goes into the uncertainty principle, to the variation in the potential. So what that means is that this term, which you call the quantum correction, that this can be very small, can be negligible. For macroscopic systems. So this is in a lot of introductory textbooks on quantum mechanics. What it shows is that for macroscopic quantum systems, where we have the center of mass of the system is subjected to some, say, external force, the variation in the force is on kind of long length scales. And so what that means is that we recover approximately Newton's laws. So I won't write it out again. Basically, this and higher order terms can be presumed to be negligible, and we get approximately, this is approximately true. Now, what does it mean if that's approximately true? Well, it means we've recovered Newton's laws. So the quantum wave packet can be a narrow, can be narrow, and the centroid of the wave packet so these equations are isomorphic to Newton's laws, and so the centroid of the wave packet can follow a classical equation. So this seems somehow to be an adequate description of the classical limit. He calculated for, I think, a particle of 1 gram, given some initial uncertainty for a coherent state where the spread in the momentum wasn't too big, and calculated that you get something like 10 to the 10 years before for a free particle. And you start from a narrow wave packet. I think you have the wave packet. So delta Q at time 0 was of order 1 angstrom. And it was 10 to 10 years before before delta Q. For T equals 10 to 10 years, delta Q is approximately equal to 1 centimeter. So in other words, it would take enormous time scales before we would see a quantum mechanical state diffuse so that we had to worry about a macroscopic superposition. Yeah?
Maybe this isn't a good point, but like 10 to 10 years doesn't seem like that long of a time to compare it to, like the enormous amount of particles around. Wouldn't we see eventually like odds and ends of these guys doing this?
Let me just double check the exact number. I think that's one of the, it was 10 to the 14 years. Does that make you feel better? I think that's one of the lifetime of the universe, all the universe in
close. Yeah, we're still
alright. So the number of particles wouldn't come in. Right? It would just be the masses of individual particles that would be all in localized wave packets. The idea is that you can get quantum mechanical effects on small scales where the forces, the variation in the forces vary on the length of angstroms. But for macroscopic objects, the forces vary on larger length scales, meters, then you don't see the quantum mechanical spread. So the center of mass of large objects would approximately follow Newton's laws, according to this argument. The center of mass of the collection of particles. So that actually was sufficiently influential that it became basically the textbook dogma on why we don't have to worry about quantum. I mean, obviously, if you can build, like Anton is trying to do, some double slit experiment for a massive object, you can, I mean, here we've assumed a free particle has its own, which is a very generic situation. When you look at a situation like a double slit experiment, then you have a very non-generic Hamiltonian. There you're constructing slits, which means the potential is varying on some very short length scale, given by the Dubois wavelength. And then you see quantum mechanical effects in the interference fringes at the screen. But that's, of course, a very controlled experimental situation. And when you do those experiments, and you can do them for buckyballs, as we saw, then you can see quantum mechanical effects. But in generic situations of describing baseballs and planets, we aren't preparing double slit experiments, and we don't have to worry about it. So it turns out that this is not a complete analysis of the problem because of the fact that Ehrenfest was working at a time before more complicated dynamics were understood, namely chaotic dynamics. So I can't give you, of course, a complete lecture on classical chaos. So what I can do is point out the kind of qualitative and quantitative features of chaos which are relevant to this discussion. So as many of you may have heard, you can think of you can track the motion of classical particles in a phase space, where p and q are the independent coordinates. We can have a multi-dimensional phase space if we want. And we represent classical systems as points in the phase space. These points represent their physical properties. This is its position q, this is its momentum p, they have definite values. That point will move around in the phase space. Now, classical chaos is the discovery of systems, Hamiltonian systems, for example. There's no dissipation, there's no chaos, but there's no open systems. We're dealing with closed systems here. So the discovery, even very simple closed systems with just a few degrees of freedom, can have properties such that if you have two nearby points, they diverge apart exponentially quickly. So we have a point x and a point x prime, where x represents q and p. We'll be using this notation throughout the lecture. These are the phase space coordinates. We can define a distance measure between x and x prime. For example, x minus x prime. And then what chaotic systems are systems for which this function grows very rapidly, typically, well, rigorously, exponentially, as a function of time. So here, these are time-dependent coordinates. So these are the coordinates at some initial time. This is our t equals 0 set of points. Where here, lambda sub L is called the Lyapunov exponent, sometimes spelled with a y. So this is only possible because the system is generically non-integrable. So it has to be non-linear. We have to have 3 degrees of freedom, that's it. It means you either have to have two positions and two momenta, or you have to have one position, one momenta, and an external driving. That's a detail. The important point is that the distance measure grows exponentially. Now this, well, the phase space is typically bounded. If you specify the energy, you can kind of draw a box around the allowed states of the system. So this exponential growth can only persist, obviously, can only persist until the distance reaches somehow the dimensions of the phase space omega. But that can be a very long time scale. If you start out with very, very closely related initial points, this time scale can be very large. But generally speaking, the time scale in which you would reach the system dimension would be given by one of the live Kuhn of exponent and the log of some measure of the system size, which I'll call d of omega, over the initial distance. So this is how we characterize classical chaos for properties, for systems with definite properties. Yeah?
D omega is the same as
dimension
omega?
Yeah, I mean, basically I'm being a little bit sloppy. The dimensions here are kind of funny because x has a length and a momentum scale. And so you have to kind of keep track of dimensions properly. But this would be the same dimensions as that. The point is that whatever length scale you define, it's not going to matter because only the ratio appears. So it's not big to go. All right, so is that qualitatively clear to everyone? So how does this impact Ehrenfest theorem? Well, it turns out that what we can do is actually we can expand. We can expand the fourth function, f of q, in Ehrenfest theorem. We can take a chaotic Hamiltonian model, or just a generic Hamiltonian model. We can expand about, last time we expanded about the quantum expectation value. This time we can expand about the classical trajectory. So I'll drop the subscript. And then what you get is f evaluated at the classical trajectory, so I'll keep the subscript, plus q minus the classical trajectory. These are all time-dependent coordinates. Times df by dx, f by dq, plus higher order terms. And then we take the expectation value of both sides, doesn't affect anything here, and we get the expectation value here. And then what we can do is we can study the time development of the difference between the quantum expectation value, and then we take the distance between the quantum expectation value and the classical coordinate. Take that distance function. And we find that the distance function, I don't know how rigorously I want to do this, but basically what you find is that the dynamics of this, the growth rate, is the distance function, are determined by df by dq. What I should do is really, for a general Hamiltonian function, we can have f be a function of q and p. So we have h of q and p. So there should be an h here. And then what we have is, for Newton's laws, okay, the derivation of these laws comes from the fact that dq by dt is equal to dh by dp. And dp by dt qi is equal to minus dh by dqi. We hear qi and pi are a list of coordinates. So q1, p1, qn, pn. So if we imagine, I mean, in the special case of the Hamiltonian of the form, here, what I didn't write explicitly is I was assuming a Hamiltonian of the form, p squared over 2m plus v of q is what Ehrenfest considered. And you can have more general Hamiltonians, obviously. And this is the generalized set of equations to describe the dynamics. And similarly, you have a dh by dq. I should make these partials, actually. And dh by dp. And the reason why that's significant is because the way you determine this exponential growth, usually numerically, has to do with the eigenvalues of this matrix of derivatives. And generically chaotic systems, so this matrix of derivatives controls the growth of the difference between the points. And what this implies is that if the system is chaotic, if the classical Hamiltonian is chaotic, then when we calculate the time evolution of the differences between the quantum expectation values and the classical phase-based point, we generically get an exponential growth of the differences. So what this entails, and this hasn't really been proven rigorously, but is the product of 10 years or so of numerical results from a large number of people, what you find is that also the variance, delta Q, for the quantum system grows exponentially. At a rate given by with exponent lambda L. So what you find is that the differences between the quantum and classical, and we call this DQCC, or DQC, the quantum classical differences grow exponentially at this rate, and similarly the quantum variance also grows exponentially at this rate. So there's a class of systems which exist in the macroscopic world, which are chaotic, for which this type of argument is not going to hold. We're going to get the correction terms, either in this picture or in this picture, will grow exponentially. So the significance of this has been debated quite a bit. And I guess the view that ultimately I was convinced by was one put forward by Wojciech Zurek, who pointed out that like, this is physically significant, because if we consider a chaotic system like Hyperion, which is the moon of Saturn, it has a lifetime of its moon has been measured. It has it's very aspherical, the satellite. And so the influence of the other satellites around Saturn leads to the fact that its precession about its own axis is a chaotic tumble with a measurable light of its exponent. And so as a result of that, one can calculate the time scale on which one would have a macroscopic coherence of its different tumbling differences. So that the quantum variance here would have some length scale of order of the diameter of that satellite, which is some tens of kilometers. And Zurek calculated that the time scale on which delta Q was of order the diameter of the satellite itself. Actually, I think just to overestimate things, he might have demanded that the variance was much larger. But anyways, what he came up with was 20 years as the time scale for significant corrections, quantum mechanical corrections, Euler-Ehrenfest. And so Zurek's solution to this obvious paradox was to point out that, well, actually, all we have this environment, we have these environment particles, which we have to include in the description. And that's going to destroy the coherence between different positions of the precession axis of the satellite. So the conclusion drawn from this is that, well, you need decoherence to really get a picture from quantum mechanics that's consistent with our macroscopic knowledge that Newtonian dynamics is correct under a wide variety of circumstances, including chaotic circumstances. So I think that, while true, is not relevant. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop that line of thought and tell you about why we don't have to worry about this. So we talked about classical chaos for properties, definite properties that exist, object properties of classical objects, its position and its momentum. Yeah?
But before you drop that, I'm not sure how to take that because you sort of just skimmed over the thing with the moon, and it's not completely clear to me how there's no way that we can get classical behavior out of this moon other than through heat coherence or through some other method.
Well, I'm going to show you now why you can get classical behavior without this moon.
Okay.
So instead of talking about classical chaos for properties, let's talk about classical chaos for knowledge. Or just general, in fact, just general dynamics for knowledge. So this was a problem posed by Newville. It's actually his first name, I don't know. In the 19th century. He said, okay, so we have Hamilton's theory of classical mechanics, which is great. He says, but in practice, we don't ever know anything with infinite precision. We just have some finite resolution in our measurements. And what this leads to is a statistical distribution of possibilities, classically. Okay? I won't write that out. So he says, so in practice, we have our phase space. And all we really know is that the object, which exists and is real, is somewhere within this blob on phase space. You can think of this as somehow a Gaussian with contours. But for simplicity of the discussion, let's just assume it's some flat distribution with some finite support. And then he said, well, how do we describe the time evolution of this knowledge we have about the system's real properties? And what he did is he derived the generalization of Hamilton's laws. And he said, let's describe this as a density on the phase space. And let's allow it to have time dependence, where we assume that each point evolves according to Hamilton's laws. And what he derived was this partial differential equation from the continuity equation and other considerations. Where this object, here I've suppressed the arguments on the row. This object is called a Poisson bracket. So the Poisson bracket of two functions, A and B, on the phase space is equal to, I might get the ordering wrong here, but you can just check it. What is it, plus or minus? Minus? Minus dA by dP. Now notice the similarity. This was actually how we, in the old days, and actually still today, I guess, people quantize classical systems by just assuming that you take the classical functions A and B, and you just replace, you know, the commutator for the algebra elements as phi h bar times whatever you got from the classical theory. I mentioned this at the beginning of the course. This is that kind of bootstrapping method where you use classical mechanics to define your quantum theory. This Poisson bracket is actually fundamental to the classical formalism. It's not just some strange function. It's when you study classical mechanics formally, you find that this is the essential object, one of the essential objects. So this is nice. And so what does this tell us? Well, what this tells us is that we can calculate the time evolution of this density. Now, let me just mention something really interesting about this, which is that this is a partial differential equation. We can actually express the dynamics as an integral equation. Where U here is a unitary operator. This is a classical phase-based density. Because it's a unitary operator, there exists a self-adjoint exponent, so we can write this as g di lt for the operator L. Is equal to I h, and then it acts on something. It acts on the density. So what we have is a unitary representation of the dynamics when we consider phase-based densities, which is, of course, very analogous to quantum mechanics. It turns out that the kind of the analysis of this unitary operator is very different from quantum mechanics because it has kind of a mixed spectrum, generally continuous and discrete. The eigenvectors don't belong to the Hilbert space. They're linear functionals. And it's a branch of math. It actually requires some knowledge of mathematics that I don't have and I'm trying to acquire. But the formal similarity is quite striking. But what's even more important in this formal mathematical parallel is the fact that we can calculate the time evolution of averages. So you have some function A. Let's call it O. O is an observable function on the phase space. So for example, O might just be the position or the momentum. And we can ask, what's the time evolution of the average value of O obtained on repeated preparations of the same system with the same uncertainty? And what you get is, well, it's defined first mean by an expectation. By the expectation of O, classically, what you mean is an integral over the phase space times the density. Where the density, the time evolution, is given by this equation. Which actually is a very simple, actually there's another representation of this, which is quite nice, which is, let me just use a more compact notation. Delta x minus y t given x times rho 0. So here I've suppressed the key value to x comma 0. Oh, sorry. Let me call this t prime. So in other words, what you do is you just propagate where y of t prime comma x is the solution of Hamilton's equations for a point. So you start at the point x, you evolve for time t prime. This point here takes you to a new point, y. So this is x, and this is y. And so if we evolve, in other words, we evolve using Hamilton's law at each point within the density, and then weight each point by the initial density, then we have a... Okay, that digression was unnecessary. This is useful for proving things like the no cloning theorem classical. So, an example of that. All right, so where am I? Yeah, so this is defined by classical expectation value. And we can ask, okay, well, how do we time evolve classical expectation values? Well, you can solve this problem requires integration by parts. And what you get is which you can expand about the classical centroid, and you get f of q of c plus delta q squared over 2 times d squared f by dq evaluated at q equals the centroid. Where here, this delta q squared is defined as q squared minus q squared. Plus the exact same higher order terms as you would get in the original Fehrenfest theorem. So all of a sudden, we've now seen that, well, actually, these aren't quantum corrections. These are corrections of our uncertain, these are corrections that appear also in the classical theory that we described indeterminate initial conditions. So there's nothing quantum mechanical about these corrections at all. They don't reflect any kind of special laws of quantum mechanics. So, well, this right away shows that Zurich's argument has some problems, because all of a sudden he was worried about the growth of his variance leading to quantum corrections in the dynamics of this macroscopic object. But really what this says is that given some initial uncertainty in our knowledge of the position, we have some later uncertainty that can be understood in an entirely classical way. So before I go on to the next point, unless if anyone anticipates a problem with this picture. Yeah.
In the quantum case, right, when you have a correction, that points to a violation of Newton's laws. But in the neutral theory, the uncertainty has to do with our ignorance. So if you actually know the position of the particle, there will be no problem with Newton's laws.
I don't know what you might call it. I mean, this isn't a problem with Newton's laws. It says, given a certain context. but I don't have perfect information. The correction term to the Newton's laws, if I had a particle at the centroid, what this tells us actually is that the centroid is not a physical object. It's evolving according to some correction term. But rather, the centroid represents some average information we have. And that average information follows a different law than Newton's laws, of course. Because here's a simple example. Suppose you have a double well potential. And you start at some density of points at the node here. And suppose that it's weighted such that there's a little more weight beyond the right-hand side. It's a perfectly symmetric potential if I draw it better. So now, any individual point, except for the points exactly at the unstable fixed point, will evolve and oscillate and come as high as they started, and then oscillate back and oscillate back. And all the particles here will do that too. That's what the physical trajectories do. What does the classical expectation value do on the position? Well, what it does is it goes down and comes up, and goes down and comes up. It's completely non-classical, because it's not a physical object. It just goes back and forth like that, and it violates classical laws of physics. But it's not a physical particle. It's some kind of information quantity. So that's an illustration of what this correction term does, how it influences it there. So anyways, no one's told me yet what the problem with this picture is. It's not really a problem, per se. I mean, there's a solution to it. Yeah?
We should be looking at, we have a beam of quantum mechanics expressing a lot of knowledge, a density basis. And so maybe we should use right Fermi's theorem for a density basis.
That's a good idea. It's not what I'm looking for, though. Okay, maybe some of the researchers. Why is this surprising? Quantum mechanics is different than classical mechanics. How can I have the exact same equations? It's impossible. Right? You know there are quantum corrections. So what's the solution?
The corrections are in the Poisson brackets and the commutators. That's where the difference is.
There's no Poisson brackets here.
No, I mean, but the difference is not there. It's the whole difference between this quantum mechanics and the...
I agree with you, that's true, but why aren't the differences showing up in my expectation values? I can't do quantum mechanics with Newton mechanics. There are quantum corrections. Where are they? It's really simple. You guys have to kick yourselves when you think of it.
Thanks.
Nope. All right, I won't waste too much time. So this is not a closed system of equations. So if I want to describe this time evolution, I have to know the time dependence of this guy, which is unspecified by these two equations. So that means I have to also calculate the time evolution of delta q squared by dt. And similarly, the next higher order term is the delta q fourth term, I think. I think the third one cancels. But anyways, the point is you have all these powers, and you have to know all of them. But I'm going to tell you right now that actually all of these powers, well, what happens is that you end up getting terms that start appearing. When you do this quantum mechanically. So classically, you get a certain set of terms. Quantum mechanically, you do it, and we have to use Schrodinger's equation, right? Quantum mechanically, you do it, and you get terms that start having h bars popping in times terms. And these are the quantum corrections. Let me show you exactly how to derive that in a very compact way using the Wigner phase space formalism. It's driving me crazy. All right. So in one of your assignments, you learned about the Wigner function, which is defined as it's a quasi probability density defined on the phase space, defined by the transform there's both some H bars in here. Actually, I put the two here, so there's no two there. Anyways, within a factor of two, that's it. And then a fellow by the name of Moyal derived the time evolution of this object, which I think I mentioned in my earlier lectures. Which is given by the Poisson bracket plus some correction terms. Okay, so actually, bear in mind that this form assumes that H can be written as P squared plus 2 over N plus V of Q. Otherwise, you would also have terms of derivatives with respect to P in here. But notice that when N is equal to 1, this is a third derivative, so the P squared term doesn't give a contribution. But if you consider generalized Hamiltonians, then you have to worry about those terms. And then it's a simple exercise using integration by parts and so on to calculate the time dependence of any vile ordered observable. So this would be something that would go in those higher order moment equations there. And what you get is the expectation value of H rho. So vile ordered means that there's this operator ordering ambiguity in quantum mechanics, which is that if I give the operator the classical system operator Q squared times P, which has mixed operators, then what's the appropriate quantum operator? Is it QPQ or is it Q squared P plus PQ squared? We have to have Hermitian combinations. And so that's the ordering ambiguity. There's a specific ordering called the vile ordering ambiguity, which this all is true if your operator is vile ordered and your Hamiltonian is vile ordered. The Hamiltonians are this form, then it's automatically, this problem doesn't arise. But just bear that in mind as well. And then you get, again, the sequence of corrections. So I noticed that some people in their assignment, when they wrote this out, said, so we see now that we get the classical limit smoothly because there's an h bar here. And so as h bar goes to 0, which is shorthand for h bar over some characteristic action going to 0, of course, these terms vanish. But it's not at all that trivial. These derivatives with respect to p, you look at this function here, bring down powers of h bar, inverse h bar. So actually, these terms don't trivially vanish. So it's the same sum. We have the same stuff here. Oh, except now it's n plus 1 in the power. And then what we get here is we get d 2 to the n plus 1 times a over dp 2 to the n plus 1 times dh 2 to the n plus 1 dq 2 to the n plus 1. And of course, I'll take an expectation value around this guy. Remember, these expectation values are Wigner phase-based representation expectation values, which are defined as integral over dq dp over the phase space rho w qp rho w qp, which is formally similar to our classical U-bill picture. So what that means is that when we systematically want to drive these equations, we can just figure out what the observable is for whatever order we're concerned about. Take this sum over its derivative with respect to p. And then, of course, this is just determined by the Hamiltonian. So we can easily calculate the quantum corrections. So let me just now make some qualitative points about this. So first of all, even though this doesn't trivially vanish when h bar goes to 0 limit, what you can show is that for generic chaotic Hamiltonians, and this is based on a random matrix on size, that these correction terms end up being, in some sense, negligibly small. So what that means is that the quantum for a generic chaotic system, where we had this big paradox and we tried to get Newtonian mechanics out of quantum mechanics, when we tried to describe real properties of macroscopic observables using the states as representing our complete description of reality, we found that we had this big paradox. which was resolved by decoherence, or can be resolved by decoherence. But here we see that, actually, if we think of the quantum state as representing information, then we have an expression where the quantum in the macroscopic limit, we have a very nice convergence to the classical information description, with corrections that end up being very small and very difficult to observe due to their smallness. Yeah?
What makes you say that the first term is classical? It's, I mean, it's PW, but nothing necessarily to do with classical probability.
It's a little typo, actually. But yeah, you can see here, right, the rise is classical. And what you can do is you can assume you start out with a quantum state that is classical, like a coherent state, which is all positive. So that the bigger phase space function is a valid probability distribution for that quantum state. And then that means your initial conditions are all classically valid. And then what this tells you is the correction terms, that you will get correction terms dynamically, and that those correction terms I'm claiming without proving to you, in fact, this hasn't been published yet, are generically small. Okay. But you can see at least, even without that additional information provided, you can see how we have a very different picture, we have a very different structure to the quantum corrections, which are now real quantum corrections. And then this original argument really should be viewed with a lot more suspicion. So basically, I would go so far as to say that quantum mechanics does not give us our complete description of macroscopic reality. That maybe is a contentious claim, but the weaker claim, which I think is more easily accepted, is that the classical limit of quantum mechanics is Liouville mechanics, and it's for that reason that I personally view either options 2 or 3 at cognitive levels being the relevant ones to pursue. Either the quantum state is either partially real or not real at all.
Yeah. How do you, your first claim, the contentious claim, how do you make that at all?
How do I make that claim?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of there's a few degrees to the argument. The first is, basically the way I make the claim is I show that we know, for chaotic systems, here's the problem. For chaotic systems, we can't actually, chaotic systems follow some chaotic trajectory, which by its very nature, given any initial uncertainty, we can't track. So it's difficult to verify Newton's laws for chaotic systems. How you do it beyond some very limited precision, which your imprecision grows exponentially. Mm-hmm. So the way around that, is to say, well, what I do know is given some conservative system, I have some energy function, which is the Hamiltonian function, of my classical coordinates, which are evolving in time. And what I know is that because of energy conservation for an autonomous system, this is constant in time. So now if I say, these are physical properties of macroscopic chaotic systems. I can't predict their detailed motion, but at any point in time, if I measure them, I can determine to high precision this value. So now I ask the following question. Which mathematical objects in quantum mechanics are going to provide me with the real properties that are time-evolving that satisfy this constraint? And the claim is that there's nothing in quantum mechanics that's going to give me ontic properties satisfying this constraint, which is what leads me to conclude that quantum mechanics doesn't provide, in macroscopic limit, a suitable set of ontic properties without further interpretation. So that's a subtle argument, and it requires lots of time to think about. But I mean, we can talk about that some more. Maybe that's not the most efficient use of our time.
Yeah. I don't know if this is relevant, but I don't see why you say you could not verify Newton's laws in the chaotic system. But I mean, you may not be able to predict long into the future, but at any given moment, you could measure the acceleration and the velocity and so on, and plug them into the equations and see whether the equations of motion are very near the static time.
That's a different kind of constraint. Actually, I think about that somewhere that could be useful for this argument as well. But I think maybe, yeah, that's true. I didn't think of that. I think that's pretty much it. So let me just conclude the lecture while the question period, and then we'll do our survey. So now we'll open to questions then. Yeah.
If I understand correctly, the argument is, we look at the original function, and we say that The corrections that it produces are actually corrections that we see in Bloom theory, and not in the Bloom theory.
If you can do a double slit experiment with Hyperion, and you re-prepare Hyperion a bunch of times, and you create a diffraction grating that has a width of order 10 to the minus 30 centimeters, then you can see quantum mechanical effects.
I mean, did you ever with this formula?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, actually. Now, what I haven't done and what I was meaning to do a long time ago is actually take advantage of this expression, which is actually in the appendix of my thesis. Oh, by the way, for those who are interested in the, I better say it. I put my thesis on the archive, and that's where most of this is. Largely unpublished because I've been doing too much quantum information theory. But here's the, at least it's out there. It's a weaker version of the argument in here, but I would point you to chapter 1, which has a nice introduction to all these issues, and chapter 5. Which describes this breakdown argument in much less detail, actually, because I didn't develop it as much at that point.
So that I assume that everybody knows what you mean by the archives?
Yeah, so you go to...
Anybody who doesn't know what the archives?
So you go to archive.org /abstract/quantPH, is that correct?
That's right.
Awesome.
Or you do go to archive.org. And then you have a list of different subjects. One of them is quantum physics.
Yeah, if we're looking for your thesis, you can just stick in your name.
Yeah, just search it out. All right, so we have a half an hour left, and what I'd like to do now is we've seen a variety of perspectives on interpretation, and we've seen a variety of things which may or may not be interpretations. And so, originally, the original idea was just write down the different interpretations and have a vote. Then I realized it was much more interesting. In fact, you guys told me what the right categories were. And then we can kind of creatively construct a list. So there's some obvious ones to start with, and then there's some more nuanced issues. So what are the possible interpretations we should write down for our book?
The many, many worlds.
The many, many worlds.
So Copenhagen.
Very. Yeah, I'm going to separate Orthodox.
Okay, that's one of the questions I had. Does everyone agree? Should we have Orthodox and Copenhagen together?
Well, so I'm correct. Actually, think different forms.
Yes, I agree with you.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but we didn't have anybody presenting either, and there was much confusion among the other presenters what exactly either one was.
Yeah, Valentine has this reverse naming scheme.
We can put four Heisenberg and von Neumann Dirac.
And what we can do later is we can just collapse votes. So Copenhagen following Bohr, and maybe Heisenberg. And then we have, this is von Neumann Dirac. So this is, really, for clarity, this is the one that talks about how we need a collapse, whereas Bohr just talks about how we need classical instruments, and that's all we can talk about. That's the distinction I would make. What else? You can just start yelling them out.
Statistical.
Okay, so what we'll do is we'll just brainstorm now and then we'll pare down if necessary.
existing histories. Spontaneous collapse. Should write smaller. Solipsism?
Yeah.
Is that what I heard? That's my book right there. So the thing is class, and then what do we have here? What did I forget?
Yeah, but that's not necessarily exclusive of the others.
Now, does anybody want to make a distinction between consistent histories and decoherent histories, or should we just put that all together? We only heard really about consistent histories, so we'll throw that together.
Yeah, there wasn't much.
But
strictly speaking, spontaneous collapse is not interpretation, right?
That's true. But it's a solution to the problems, the proposed solution. We'll put a little star here. Yeah. What else do we have?
Then
you put a star with the world is wrong. Why? Because it's not beginning
with conditioning.
It's going beyond the treasure. With non-equilibrium
conditions, you mean?
Or?
No, but it's going beyond and
there's
an extra
space.
But
it says
the world is classical, so you don't need it.
There's it's not quantum theory. Could really go back to the quantum theory, whereas spontaneous collapse is actually inconsistent. Sorry, is not consistent with quantum. It's consistent with observations so far, but it's fundamentally a different model than quantum mechanics.
Yeah,
whereas the Rolle-Bohm is an extension of quantum mechanics.
And what, how's that?
Well, you'd never be able to distinguish between the two. The Rolle-Bohm's constructed to
unless you find a pilot's
I think we should add non-equilibrium to Rolle-Bohm, or just non-equilibrium to as an option. Do people agree with that? Or? What kind of subject?
Agnostic.
Okay, what about the there is no problem interpretation? We've all been wasting our time.
So we're going towards the limit that there's as many interpretations as there are people in the room.
So I don't think they'll all be fine. But is there is no problem the same really as the Copenhagen interpretation?
Well, I think all the same.
There's no problem. The null or shut up and calculate interpretation.
Alright, whatever you calculate.
Yeah,
you can get that interpretation. You claim there is no interpretation.
Yeah.
Just bad
math. No, you just won't talk about it. You just don't. I'm sorry, let's play up now.
Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't have someone present the decoherence point of view, which may or may not only work with the many worlds, but does anyone want to have decoherence as a separate category?
Yes.
It all makes sense now. Should I call it the decoherence rules interpretation? All right. Anything else? There is a problem, but these don't solve it. There's something totally different we need. All right, I like that. I guess that's to decide. What about quantum logic? Is that a quantum logic based interpretation? It could be a kind of an approach.
It's a suggestion on how to analyze things generally. It may not be an interpretation.
Well, it could be going to none of the above. Our logical approach is where we have to go.
Like an epistemological approach, where you just believe it's mathematics and state of the
world. Yeah, absolutely. Let's put that on there.
For example, how quantum gravity affects motors.
If all you basically, if you
No. No. Now, I mean, is this different than a sensible interpretation?
Yeah.
Why?
Statistically,
one at a time.
Because you're not saying it's.
But that's more
you're saying the theory of knowledge I have, not a theory of statistics that might be going on in the world. It's so background. It's what do I know?
So like a personal subjectivity as opposed to an objective?
Well, you're saying almost how much knowledge you can have.
So knowledge is of course true objective, true justified belief. So the word knowledge, should I put belief or knowledge as the qualifier for this?
So you're not all the way there.
Let's put belief down.
Sure.
See what happens.
We have an epistemic interpretation that refers to individual particles, whereas this statistical refers to collections.
For all solid systems. Okay, I like that. I emphasize individual systems. So. That's good. What about quantum information-based approaches? And what about operational approaches? Are those interpretations?
Isn't operational the same
thing? Yeah. No, it's not. I think operational approaches are more sensitive to the fact that there are issues which can be more satisfactorily dealt with. But I don't know, maybe we have an expert here on that, so. we'll put operational approaches. And what about quantum information-based approaches like Zeilinger's and others?
Was that helpful in the category?
Yeah, probably would. Does anybody want that as a separate category?
Can you do Zeilinger and call himself his
name? Yeah, we'll put his name next to it.
How much should I be talking about interpretation? Is that just not willing to interpret it?
It is still a positional.
It's a positional interpretation, which is what's great.
Anyway, the voice
no comment.
Just seems like that one should be, no one voted.
Yeah, this class.
What about, anti-realism. Do we have that?
What's anti-realism?
Well, it's kind of like solipsism in the sense that you don't believe that there is a objective reality, so expecting that there's one mechanics is maybe a little setting the bar too high. I mean, it's not so far from in this case here.
Solipsism would be a variety of that,
perhaps. Let me just combine them together. Solipsism, anti-realism. And the other thing is, what about generalized hidden variable theories? Anthony briefly mentioned Nelson stochastic dynamics. And does anybody want to put down? No? Revisions for that? Yeah. All right,
There actually might be something, although it might be longer agnostic. I don't know if you know John Gurman, he's a mathematician at Cambridge, and he talks about what I can only call a model interpretation, where you say interpretations are just models, they're not expected to be perfect.
So quantum mechanics is wrong?
No. as a classical example, when you do a gas law, you say it out of the sphere, and later you say,
it will be imprecise in some sense.
That in general, all models are like that, and so we shouldn't expect anything to be quantum.
All right, actually, what I didn't forget is modal interpretations, which we didn't cover. The leading proponent has abandoned the position, so. What do you want to call it?
Model interpretation, maybe? It sounds a little modal.
Well, I think it says that human quantum mechanics is
well, incomplete. Well, it says that all physical theories are the same. He makes the argument that all physical theories are just models and approximations. Just classical has been so ridiculous.
How about approximation?
Sure.
But that's similar to operationalism, right? So the theory is just predicting outcomes in a method.
Well, no, because in operationalism you tend to sort of discount the physical process more. Here what he's saying is the physical process is real, but when we do the mathematics, we are only modeling it. We're not literally describing it. There's some
a lot of choices.
Maybe we should be permitted to.
Or quantum gravity?
I have an approach which I will probably, if you put it there, you can call it preclusion approach.
Preclusion?
Preclusion, yeah. Because the macroscopic world is real, and quantum mechanics makes certain assertions about things that are precluded, which won't happen. And then beyond that, it doesn't make any assertions, any predictive assertions. In a formal level, mathematical level, it's uses the same formalism as the decoherent consistent history.
Oh, yeah.
It refers to the decoherent function.
Okay, so I think this is going to get at least one vote then. All right, so last call for further suggestions.
Can we get votes against interpretations?
That's a good idea. That's a very good idea.
Yeah.
That's okay. So I need kind of colored chocolate.
Let's have three positive votes and two negative.
Three votes? Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm worried that later on I might streamline this and people will like vote for two things that collapse into the same one. A double vote. Yeah, let's do one vote for, one vote against. So I guess the vote against is if you're reviewing grant applications and you say it's absolutely not be covered in the all right, what I would like to do is tally the researchers separately from the students, although we might not have enough for statistical significance.
I think that researchers should not vote. I don't.
Well, let's get a separate vote from the researchers.
I don't want to finish.
Yes.
All right, so now we have to do, it has to be like rock, paper, scissors, where as soon as I name the interpretation, you have to vote. No, it's like looking around the room, going with or against the majority.
It's just one vote or
miss. I think we'll do one vote for and vote against. So what I'll do is I'll call up the interpretation, we'll get the votes for, then we'll get the votes against, and then we'll get the researcher votes for, researcher votes. So, student vote for, student vote against, researcher vote for. Do the researchers get a vote against too? I don't know if this is like the most promising for
some. So what is the question exactly?
That's the question.
Yeah, that's your favorite intervention or way of using quantum mechanics.
One second. So, I mean, I would suggest the question, you can answer whatever question you want, basically, but I would suggest a question like, which is the most likely interpretation to really explain what's going on? Yes. Which is the most promising approach and or existing interpretation that is satisfactorily resolves our, that keeps you sleeping at night? And then the vote against is the one that you find most upsetting, especially when you read about it in the popular press.
Each person is allowed only one vote for and one vote against.
Yes, that's it. Okay, Carol?
I would like to suggest that we should like our answer not to be biased, you know?
Oh, no, I can't do that. That's too complicated. All right.
Yeah. We have to move on.
So let's think about it. All right, so, students, many worlds for.
Oh.
Many worlds against.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Wow.
All right. Researchers, many worlds for. Many worlds against. Oh, yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Good. Right. Why is my voting against it first?
I hope David Wallace never sees this lecture. Okay. Copenhagen, 4 students. Wow, I love it. All right, Nathan.
Hey. We don't
collapse
the same things together
at
this
stage. We can collapse later. Hey. Right. Against the Copenhagen, 1, 2, 3. Okay, researchers for the interpretation. Oh, we have one. Researchers against Copenhagen. I haven't even thought of what my answer is going to be. What do I want to vote against the most? I'll think about later. Okay. Orthodox, Mondo and Dirac. We have 2, 4, 3, 4. Wow.
Brothers.
Okay, so he's against the collapse of von Neumann's collapse. One, two.
There were three in favor.
There were three? This is a very scientific process. okay, researchers for Copenhagen.
Orthodox.
Orthodox, all right. Researchers against the Orthodox. So we have zero. My color scheme is wrong. All right, DeRoy Bohm. That's a good one. Students for. One, two students. Students against the DeRoy Bohm. Three. Researchers for DeRoy Bohm. Yeah, let's give Anthony the. But he might go for the non-equilibrium hidden variable. Yeah. So. Students against, researchers against the DeRoy Bohm? Right, you're voting two, right?
Oh,
a minus one? we'll raise that scale.
Yeah, okay, I'm against the DeRoy Bohm. But I would have voted for many.
All right.
He's voting for many worlds?
Yeah. statistical interpretation. Two takers. Two takers. Wow. And it's students against statistical interpretation. It's kind of hard to be against, but we have found someone who will be against it. What you're against exactly. All right. Researchers for the statistical interpretation. Researchers against the statistical interpretation.
I think we
never run
out of researchers.
Spontaneous collapse, students for? This is way too many categories.
Yeah.
Students against? Two against. Researchers for? Oh, yeah. Researchers against? I'm going against it. Anyone else against spontaneous collapse?
I think we used up all our hopes on it.
Well, who saw the world? Let's see. I don't vote, but I'm not going to vote for anything.
Well, there's an abstain one, right?
Yeah.
Agnostic. So, all right, well, consistent history, tickling history, four. Students. One, two, three. Students against it. One. Researchers for consistent histories. Sounds like a support group. Solipsism, anti-realism. No students? What? Don't see anything? All right, there's one researcher. Any students against solipsism? Researchers for solipsism? Let's leave one then. Researchers against solipsism? We'll settle that over the foosball table. So, non-equilibrium hidden variables, students. Sala? Students against non-equilibrium hidden variables. Waste of time, shouldn't be supported. Researchers in favor, we'll give Anthony his vote. Verify later. Anyone against non-equilibrium hidden variables? Yeah, all right. Agnostic. At least one agnostic, two. Did he agnostic or not abstain?
Well, it's not clear whether this was I'm agnostic to an interpretation or there is an agnostic interpretation.
No, it's agnostic to interpretation. Agnostic to interpretation.
Yes or no,
I guess.
The binary answer.
All right, researchers against, students against agnostic, researchers for agnostic, researchers against agnostic. Have all the researchers voted? Okay. Where you, tell me where you're going, and then I can just put it down and not ask the researchers every time. 15. Oh, nice. All right.
16.
16
for me. Plus
16. 16.
16, I think it's 2
there,
right?
16. Yeah. 2
plus.
I have 2. That's 3. Oh, who's the third? Oh. All right, so that's it for the researchers then? All researchers?
13
for what?
13.
None of the above. That's it for the guard?
13.
All right, did you get a vote against? Do you want to vote against anything?
I already voted against.
Okay, good. Right. So that's it for researchers. Oh, Robin?
I thought about for 19 women.
And did you get an against vote?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're all set with the researchers? All right. Let's do it. All right. I'll let, yeah, no, shut up and calculate. Shut up and calculate four. Shut up and calculate. We have a biased crowd here. Again. The people here. Someone suggested you're.
I know.
All right, so I'm a fan. Anybody against coherence?
Students.
Yeah. Students only, yeah.
Only students.
All right, good. So these are 0-0.
I agree with
it. Oh, you agree with it? And no one's against it. All right, no one's violently opposed. Good to know. All right, next we have quantum logic approaches. I actually didn't accept it.
I'm voting for none of the above.
You're voting for none of the above?
Yeah.
So that's one.
Maybe Matthew, that would just go three.
I'm not sure.
And yeah, 1-0 against none of the above.
Are you here?
Yeah, I'm
sorry.
I'm sorry.
Who went none of the above? I'm not so concerned about the accuracy of the none of the above. How many none of the above researchers were there in favor? One, two, two. In favor of none of the above. So quantum logic approach, Matt is definitely for that. All right, so any students for quantum logic approach? Any students against quantum logic approach?
No.
Epistemic interpretation, students for? One, two. We'll fill you on two, okay. How many against? You might get a chance to vote. Figure out which one you want to vote for. Operational approaches, students. One in favor. Any against? Modal interpretations. Any students in favor? Any students against? Okay, we can just cross that one out. QM is an approximation. One. Anybody against that? Is that it?
Yeah, preclusion.
Preclusion. Okay. I'm going to shout out if anyone wants to vote against it or for it. Is that it then? Is everybody voted both votes? I guess so. Are you doing an active tally right? Let's see, what's the big winner? So we have to add these two. Well, students alone, we have 3, 2, 2. System Histories has 3. Agnostic has 3. All right, so these are the big winners. And then for the researchers,
Orthodox did pretty well.
You didn't count the minus.
Yeah.
You should
add and subtract.
Of course.
All right. I'll tally it. I'll post it on the website. You guys can arrange the statistics however you want. But anyway, this is basically how we're doing.
So the next question that we wanted to ask is that, did any of you change your mind about interpretation of quantum mechanics or interpretation between the beginning of a class to the end?
Just considering yourself just better informed the change of mind?
I more dogmatically believe what I used to believe.
10, 11, 12.
Yeah, I mean, I'm changing it.
Because if you're questioning this question, you don't know what interpretation is.
It's good, you change your mind.
All right. Should I pass this out during the wrap up here?
Yeah. Right. So there's the evaluation form.
The evaluation forms, pass this around. Only students who are registered in the course can fill this out.
And then, Nathan, can you pick them up?
Yeah.
And you drop them off to
the next third course. I have to do this.
You what?
Third course I have to do this for.
ESC 253.
Must have a frame.